From the studios of Central Coast Public Radio, KUSP, in Santa Cruz, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf.
Here we come, walk down the street. We get the funniest looks from everyone we meet.
Hey, we're the monkeys. People say we monkey around, but we're too busy singing.
You know, you would not expect the actors from Gilligan's Island to actually go live on a desert island. You wouldn't expect Barbara Eden to actually live in a bottle. But the four young men who were hired by Bob Raffleson and Bert Schneider to portray a rock and roll group in a television series actually became that rock and roll group. The show was called The Monkees. Eric Lefkowitz is a Monkees fan, and 25 years ago, he told the Monkees' story in a little book called A Monkees' Tale. And now he tells the complete story in a slightly bigger book called Monkey Business, the revolutionary made-for-TV band. Eric Lefkowitz, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary.
And congratulations on your book. I think it's an excellent book.
Well, that's very kind.
You know, but there's a part of the story that seems sort of sad to me. Do you think of the saga of the Monkees as a happy one?
Well, not anymore, I don't. When I wrote the first book, they hadn't really had their big revival, and they were kind of under the radar for such a big pop phenomenon. People had pretty much written them off and forgotten about it. So when I was writing the first book, I was almost proselytizing for why they were interesting. The second time through, 25 years later, you get a larger arc of a story, and you can really see what happened to these guys, and I think it is a sadder story, frankly, what happened to them.
And I guess that's because, you know, 25 years ago, people either had never heard of them or they were nostalgic for the TV show. But now their presence is a lot more real. I mean, all their shows are available on DVD. I think there's a brand new Blu-ray, Criterion Blu-ray of Head. It just came out. So people are still paying attention to the Monkees. All their records are in print. I think that's pretty remarkable. And they're all, the four of them are all still alive. Although I'm not sure exactly what they've accomplished. I guess we'll talk about that in a little bit. So tell me a little bit about the four men who got the job as the Monkees. Two of them were musicians and two of them were actors.
That's right. Bob Raffleson and Bert Schneider, who were the co-creators and producers of the show, we're looking for four people to fill the slots of this prospective TV show about a fictional band, and they looked for two actors and two musicians. Peter Tork and Michael Nesmith were musicians, working musicians, barely working, but working. And Mickey Dolenz and Davy Jones had actually already been successful in varying degrees as actors.
I remember Circus Boy from when I was a kid.
Yes, Circus Boy. Mickey Dolenz was Mickey Braddock, and he rode around on elephants, and he was Circus Boy, and he was quite famous for his time, and then he completely disappeared off the radar screens, and then he came back as a monkey.
And so, tell me, how did they get the job? Let's go back a little further than that. I mean, I always assumed that Raffleson and Schneider saw Hard Day's Night and said, "Let's make a TV series out of that."
Well, that's what I thought, too, and that's what I asked both of them. Bert Schneider was a lot more forthcoming in saying that the Beatles were the inspiration behind the show, and in particular Richard Lester, who directed A Hard Day's Night. Bob Raffleson had a harder time admitting that. He seemed to say or contend that he had the idea for the Monkees long before the Beatles, that he wanted to make a show about a group of itinerant musicians, that he had been a part of a group of guys who had gone through Mexico playing music, and he'd always wanted to tell that particular story. So depending on who you believe, the Beatles were the inspiration, or Bob Raffleson just made it up before the Beatles even happened.
And I think I believe that it was based on the Beatles, is what I think. because, you know, they have Beatle haircuts, and there are four guys, you know, and all that, and one of them has a British accent. In fact, Davy Jones was actually on the Ed Sullivan Show with the Beatles, isn't that right?
Yes, that's one of those strange, obscure facts, because He was part of the cast of Oliver, which was the first real hit British musical ever to make it across the shores on Broadway. So he was a rising star, and the cast of Oliver sang on that same historic show. But like other acts that played on that show, they're all pretty much forgotten. The Beatles completely dominated, and you can only wonder what Davy Jones was thinking. He probably thought this is his big break on American television, and all anyone could talk about were the Beatles.
And some of the other people who auditioned, I guess you mentioned in your book that I guess there's one truly famous guy who auditioned to be a monkey, and that would be Steve Stills.
I was afraid you were going to say Charlie Manson, because I'm actually partially responsible for that urban legend that started for a while about Charlie Manson being in the Monkees. But Steve Stills was actually seriously considered. By the way, Manson was in jail at the time, and that was a rumor that Rodney Dingenheimer. Yeah, he started that rumor. But I have to say that Steven Stills, I can't really imagine what would have happened if he had become a monkey. It would have altered the history of rock and roll. You might not get the Buffalo Springfield. Maybe Neil Young doesn't become quite as famous. I mean, there's a lot of dominoes that fell a certain direction because Steven Stills had a receding hairline and his teeth weren't that good. And also, apparently, he wanted to write his own songs. And from the start, Rafelson and Schneider were intent on controlling the copyrights.
Not just the copyrights, but I mean, they, as I was saying in my introduction, they basically hired these guys to portray rock and roll stars. Did they actually intend for them to become rock and roll stars?
I guess in the master plan they did. They really did want them to record and to cohere and as a group and express themselves. And they gave them fairly wide berth, but it took a while before that happened. And really, the Monkees did get control of their career, but it was just past the peak of their commercial prime when they got to get a measure of control. So it's a controversial aspect of the project, really, how Rafelson and Schneider kind of manipulated these four guys, because they sort of promised them the world, and they did deliver the world there for a while, but when the Monkees were over, those two producers, they went on to their own fame and fortune, but they never really lifted a finger for the Monkees again after 1968.
Well, let's talk about the music a little bit. There was a guy hired to create their music for them, a guy that those of us who remember the 1970s know well from his own television show, and that's Don Kirshner.
Yes, the golden ear. Don Kirshner is the bête noir of the Monkees story. He's the he was a publishing magnate at the time, and he'd already made quite a lot of money publishing songs for great songwriting teams out of the Brill Building. And he had sold off his company and was producing music for television shows, including I Dream a Genie and Bewitched. Two of the songwriters that were primary in creating the Monkee sound, Bobby Hart and Tommy Boyce, were under his roof, and he had gotten them slots on those shows. And they ended up being the primary architects of the first record and the song Last Train to Clarksville, the Monkees theme, and a lot of great songs, actually.
That was the first single, right? The Last Train to Clarksville.
Yeah, what's remarkable about that song is it's obviously a durable pop hit, but the actual creation of the song occurred about 4 to 5 weeks before the show was due to air. So they literally pulled that single out of the air, and it became a smash hit even before the series debuted. But
I remember when they were playing it on the radio before the show came on, and it was like to hype us for the show.
That's right, but they had a real hit single to hype this this band, and I think that's really incalculable, like how powerful that was to have a hit song for a group that didn't even really exist yet.
So what did they do? Did they just record the entire song except for the vocals, and then they brought in Mickey Dolenz to do the vocal, or how did that work?
Well, what happened was a pilot had been made where Boyce and Hart did sing all the songs, and that pilot sold the series. And later, the Monkees went back and sang those tracks before that episode when it aired. But Last Train to Clarksville came about because they needed lots of music. For every episode, they had to have at least two songs. And as it turned out, it wasn't that easy to find a producer who could come up with those tracks. And that's why they turned to Boyce and Hart. They really, Boyce and Hart were a great songwriting team that wrote a lot of hits even before the Monkees, but they actually had no track record when it came to producing hits. And they were running out of time. They had the first record that had to be released, and essentially they came up with Last Train to Clarksville. They had tremendous session players on there. I mean, really the cream of the crop of L.A.'s session players is on that song. Amazingly, you know, they pulled it out of thin air and got themselves a number one hit.
We're talking with Eric Lefkowitz, and his new book is called Monkey Business, The Revolutionary Made-for-TV Band. You know, a lot has been made and sort of aspersions cast at the Monkees at the time because they didn't play their own instruments. Although, when you look back at the history of popular music, I mean, lots and lots and lots of famous popular musicians did not play their own instruments, including rock and roll stars. I think you mentioned Sonny and Cher in the book and lots of others. So why was that such a big deal?
I think it was because of the overwhelming success of it. I think it just inspired jealousy. I think it inspired hatred from older Beatles fans who saw it as a ripoff, and their younger brothers and sisters were latching on to the Monkees, and they had to make sure to abuse them for being fans. Also, the fact that the Monkees could put their music on the TV show and promote it that way, within the industry, was a very threatening notion. For example, radio programmers like to get paid off. This is obviously a famous story in music, payola. And the fact that the Monkees could break a single on a TV series really made those people nervous.
But eventually, of course, they did play their own instruments. Their first two albums, correct me if I've got the chronology wrong, but I recall The Monkees and then More of the Monkees. Those are the first two albums, and those are Don Kirshner's musicians and Don Kirshner's songs and so forth?
Right, they are. Don Kirshner was kind of the executive producer of the first couple of albums. From the start, The Monkees, in particular Nesmith and Peter Tork, were agitating to be on the records, but there was a policy not to let these guys play their instruments, because if you could get Glenn Campbell to play it, you might as well hire Glenn Campbell, because you had to have these guys on the TV set making the show and shooting their promotional spots, what have you. So the first two records, almost born out of necessity, had to be made that way. By the third record, they had already rebelled, but it's important to note from the start, they wanted to record their own music, and Michael Nesmith did get a chance to go into the studio very early on in the process and prove himself, and he was a canny character because he managed to get a couple of songs on those first couple of records, and they're some of the largest selling records of the 60s. Those were blockbuster albums, so I think, you know, Mike Nesmith was a clever guy to make sure that he had some songs on those records.
And then their third album, the legendary Headquarters, that's the album that all of them actually play all the instruments and do all the vocals.
They do. They have the assistance of Chip Douglas, who had just done a tenure with the group The Turtles and had helped produce and arrange the hit Happy Together. And the Monkees were really fit to be tied about Kirshner. It's quite a long, drawn-out story about what happened there, but eventually what happened was Kirshner was fired from the project for putting out a single that angered everybody, basically, because the Monkees were supposed to get the B-side of the next single, and Kirshner rushed out a single without their participation, and he was summarily fired. And then after the season ended up filming, the Monkees went in for 6 weeks and made their own record. A real do-it-yourself approach to making music, because these guys were still pretty green when it came to you know, being in a recording studio. Fortunately, it was RCA Records, and It was a very good recording studio, and they made a fascinating record.
Well, that's Headquarters, and that has, you know, some of my favorite songs. Shades of Grey is on that album, isn't it?
Shades of Grey is on that record.
That's
and,
a great.
That's
a great record.
Oh, that's a great record. That's you know, I'm surprised it didn't become a hit. I think it didn't quite jibe with an AM audience. It was they may have been aiming their sound a little bit at the FM audience, but there was no way the Monkees were going to get be played on underground FM radio. I think they would have loved it. They certainly did a bunch of bizarre music, not so much on Headquarters, but afterwards that would have fit in on some playlists. But these guys really couldn't buy any credit. You know, they had gold records, they had Emmy Awards, they were hanging out with the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix. You know, they had a lot of great experiences, but credibility was a long, long time coming.
Well, you did mention in the book, and I was like, oh, wow, that's so amazing, that at some point in 1967, in the summer of 1967, the top albums in the country were Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and Headquarters and Surrealistic Pillow by the Jefferson Airplane and Flowers by the Rolling Stones. Headquarters was right in there with those classics.
That's right. It sold 3 million records, which is incredibly impressive achievement for a group that, you know, had basically, a year before, they didn't even know each other, and a year later, they're in a recording studio trying to hash it out, literally and figuratively, make this record. And it did start to slowly go downhill, although there's some real musical peaks after that record. But I think if you really want to hear what the Monkees sounded like as a foursome, I think you have to hear that record.
So the television series was a success on NBC, but after two seasons, it ended.
It burned really white hot and flamed out. The whole phenomenon was as hot as any phenomenon could be. It was it just dominated while it was at its peak. And then I think after 2 years of making the show, and it was a difficult show to make, there were lots of setups. They would film 40, 50, 60 scenes for that rapid style of editing that they used. So it was physically draining, and it was mentally draining, and I think by the end of the second season, NBC was happy to see these guys go. They had become pains in the neck. They kind of believed their hype in a way, I think. I mean, from everything I've been told, their egos kind of got out of control.
Well, here's our what if question, Eric. I know these are kind of crazy questions, but what if they had released their next album, Head, as Torque, Dolenz, Nesmith, and Jones, and dropped the Monkees? And do you think they could have escaped the label of the Monkees and gone on in the way that other musicians did?
Short answer is no, I don't think so. They shortly after Headquarters, they made a really great record, actually, Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Jones. It has some fantastic tracks. It's really an evocative record, and it has some interesting songs, including songs by Harry Nilsson and others. But by that time, they had stopped playing on each other's sessions, and there was a huge rift between Peter Tork and Michael Nesmith. It's never really been explicated exactly what went down there, but they stopped playing on each other's tracks, and basically they went the White Album route in a funny way, where they all started making their own music, and it was all stuck on a record, but there was no unity anymore. The movie Head is probably the exception to the rule there. They really did come together to make that film, although that film turned out to be career suicide, so it all kind of rebounded on them. I don't think that they were that personally close to have been able to pull that off.
So, in other words, you feel their downfall was sort of inevitable?
I think it was absolutely inevitable. In fact, I think it was in the cards, and that's something I go into a bit at the end of the book about how they were essentially orphaned You know, they were left on the doorstep after Rapelson and Schneider really went on to do the things that made them famous. For Rapelson, it was directing Five Easy Pieces. For Schneider, it was making the Vietnam documentary Hearts and Minds. And they also produced Easy Rider, which actually was probably the biggest career leap for them right there. That was right after the Monkees, and it was made with the money that the Monkees had made for them.
Take the last train to Pottsville, and I'll meet you at the station. You can be here by 4:30, because I've made your reservation. Don't be slow. No. Only true in fairy tales, and for someone else, but not for me. Our love was out to get me, and that's the way it seemed. Disappointment haunted all my dreams. Then I saw her face. Now I'm a believer. Not a trace of doubt in my mind. I'm in love. I'm a believer. I couldn't leave her if I tried. Well, goodbye, dear. I just can't take this chance.
In terms of the money, they didn't get a very big piece of the money. I mean, they had a lot of money, but what happened to it?
They had, they really all spent it, which was a shame. I think Mickey was probably pretty canny because he had been in showbiz for a while, and Michael Nesmith's mother famously invented liquid paper. That didn't make him wealthy, but it certainly didn't hurt to know that there was this multi-million dollar company that he would inherit one day. But when it comes down to the financials of the Monkees, they really got ripped off, plain and simple. I mean, they made a lot of money, but they probably should have made a lot more money. And that's still a bone of contention. I believe that's something that they're all bitter about.
Even now, as Rhino Records markets their music, and they seem to have a never-ending stream of reissues and re-releases, and previously unreleased deluxe box sets of so forth. Do the Monkees themselves get any royalties for any of that stuff?
They get paid. Yes, they do. There's mechanical royalties and songwriting royalties. But by and large, the money for them, when it comes to the Monkees, is for the touring, and they haven't been able to get that together for a long time. There's a deal on the table, apparently, for them to tour next summer. The only acts that can sell tickets these days, it seems, are legacy rock acts. And since the Monkees are all alive, as you pointed out, if they could reunite, there's a lot of money on the table for them to do it. But apparently, so far at least, they haven't been able to patch up their differences.
Do they like each other or not?
Well, it would be hard for me to say. You know, I'm sure there's a lot of unexpressed love for each other because they certainly went through something together that was absolutely unique. They, in a sense, they were comrades, you know, and they were thrown together, and they went to the highest heights. But I think there are a lot of personal problems. I know that Mickey and Davey were very close. They were actors, and, you know, they came together very quickly with the show and were quite tight. But I believe that they're like the Sunshine Boys now. They can't stand the sight of each other, apparently. And now this is all hearsay, but, you know, I hear a lot of back-channel stuff, and it's sad to me. I wish they could just patch it up for the sake of entertaining us, you know. There's certainly I think a lot of people out there that would enjoy a quality Monkees performance one more time before it's all said and done. But it's possible the last train has already left the station. I'm not sure it's ever going to happen.
Well, their reunion efforts in the past have not been all that interesting.
No, I agree. They have not. Now, they were catapulted back to fame by MTV because MTV in 1986 broadcast 22 straight hours of Monkees episodes out of the blue to a whole new generation of kids who had never probably even heard of the Monkees. And MTV was, well, this is the era of Michael Jackson and Madonna and, you know, that era of MTV when they actually played music videos. And for the Monkees to kind of gate crash through that and suddenly have their show back on, well, not nationwide television, but nationwide cable, was a huge deal. And that they did make a lot of money from that reunion. Michael Nesmith really wasn't on board, but the three others toured for a couple of years and made some big-time money. The shows were good. The shows were actually quite good, surprisingly good. Mickey was in great form. He's really quite a winning performer live. But the other things they did, like they made a record that was just tragically bad. It's one of those dated 80s records with that terrible drum sound that, you know, whenever you hear it, you have to turn the dial. At least I do.
Yeah, no. So their original records were timeless, but their reunion records are dated.
Awful. Yeah. Awful. And again, you know, they didn't really collaborate. And the funny thing about Kirshner is that having a guy like that lording over all these songwriters and putting the greatest, you know, session musicians available at the time together with the Monkees' voices really did produce some timeless pop music. There's no doubt about it. So I think once the Monkees lacked direction and lacked the producer's input, they really had very little to say.
So I guess the only thing that would work if they were to get back together would be a complete reunion, which would include a reunion with Carole King, Boyce and Hart, Neil Diamond, and the people who are still living who wrote music for them.
Well, that would be quite interesting. Unfortunately, Tommy Boyce committed suicide, so Boyce and Hart couldn't do it. Obviously, Carole King has gone on really to greater things. I think the Monkees was, you know, must have really helped there because the whole Brill Building sound was on its way out when the Monkees became huge, and Carole King was one of the major songwriters of the Monkees. But obviously she went on to bigger and better things, perhaps. And then Neil Diamond, what can you say?
His new album does contain a cover of I'm a Believer.
Well, I mean, I think I'm a Believer must be one of the most lucrative songs the guy's ever written. I mean, it's just a huge, huge
Just from Shrek alone.
Just from Shrek alone. I was disappointed that Shrek used another band, Smash Mouth, to perform on that. But I think it's still identified as a Monkees song.
It's a fascinating story. It's a great book, everybody. The book is called Monkey Business, The Revolutionary Made-for-TV Band, and the author, Eric Lefkowitz. Eric, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much, Gary.
That's it for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the show and that you'll come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at KUSP.org or find us on Facebook or iTunes. As always, thanks go to our From the Bookshelf staff, the lovely Ms. Breanne Beal, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. And thanks also to Eric Lefkowitz, whose new book is called Monkey Business, The Revolutionary Made-for-TV Band. Thanks, Eric. And thank you all for listening. For From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.